Well, always it's in the web, so it should be no problem, but I will pass your notes to them and see if they... Right, okay. So, let's have a look a little bit here. I mean, page 47, the end of the third paragraph. Edmund Husserl thought to develop a new philosophical middle which will lend absolute certainty to disintegrating civilization. You see what you, Alexandra, mentioned, that indeed, if you want to establish a connection between philosophy or literary theories and a social situation, you can do that. So, if in that sense you would like to make interpretation of phenomenology or hermeneutics or reception theory, well, you certainly can address the fact that we talk about a late capitalism, a society in which the third sector, you know, this division, where are they? Oh, don't tell me, I forgot my bloody... Gosh. I always do the same. Well, you have these three... Economically speaking, you can divide a society in three stages, basically. The primary sector, if you want, is agriculture production, okay? And the secondary sector, if you want, is the industry. And the third sector is, in one way or the other, the services, banking and everything. There are some authors who make the analysis of society according to this division, okay? So let's say, for instance, underdeveloped societies are society in which the primary sector is bigger, is great, but they don't have a secondary sector. That means that they have agriculture, but they don't have industry. They were not able to produce industry. Or, by the contrary, they have agriculture, but they have a sort of huge, immense service sector. The idea, from the economical point of view, is that you should have a little bit of each one, okay? And in that sense, you will be a developed society from the economical point of view, okay? So what happened is that more and more societies tend to develop the third sector. You know, like nowadays, I mean, look you. You will be walking away from here looking for a job, or if you don't carry on with your PhD, and what is going to happen? The majority of the work that you can do are services. You know, the possibilities that you, with a degree, can go and use your hands are less than zero. Or the possibility that you can go into a, you know, line production change is, as well, less than zero, because they aren't in this country either. So you see, more and more our society do things in the third sector, in services. Everything is services. Internet services, banking is a service, university education is a service, and so on and so on. So, if we need to have a theory, philosophically speaking, to address the situation in which all the financial aspects of society, in one way or the other, have the hegemony of the idea of economy, then probably the reception theory is one of the theory who can go along very well with that. Because try to address the culture, if you want, and the literary production in a society in which you have too many elements to consider at the same time, and in which there is no one element who is relevant. I used to be in the 19th century, in which you have the author, an example, and the work, and that's it. No. Now, the author is one of the elements that you need to analyze. So, in such a society in which you need to analyze several elements at the same time, well, the reception theory probably is one of the consequence theories, one of the theory who result from this social situation. I'm not quite sure to what extent you can directly associate a certain type of society with a particular theory. Of course you can make connection, but I will be not as extreme as Eagleton is here, you see. So, as you imagine, Husserl was to write later in his The Crisis of European Sciences, between irrationalist barbarity on the one hand, and a spiritual rebirth through an absolutely self-sufficient science of the spirit on the other. I mean, for some people, the fact that we need to address our complex situation from a philosophical point of view was such an important thing that they were saying this. They were saying, or you do that, or you will be going back to the primitive stages of knowledge, basically. That was a little bit an exaggeration, but anyway, for that people, for people who was really convinced about that, that was the picture. Or you change, or you stay, or go back to the primitive stages of knowledge. I carry on. So 48. Remember what I explained before about the phenomena. So he's saying basically there is a sort of short abstract of the Husserl way to think. He says all consciousness is consciousness of something. In thinking, I am aware that my thought is pointing towards some object. To establish certainty, then we must first of all ignore or put in brackets anything which is beyond our immediate experience. We must reduce external world to the content of our consciousness alone. This so-called phenomenological reduction is Husserl's first important move. You see, they try to isolate a particular aspect in the sense in which what you can get from your experience is what exists. All the other assumptions at the moment do not exist. Why? Because we need to analyze them. Before we need to, we can assume something which is not coming from our perceptions, we need to analyze them. We analyze them, and then we conclude if we are going to take it or not. And that is, if you want, is one of the phenomenological principles. This is called ille. In Greek, ille means that, mean in some way suspension. Is the idea that you suspend that to see what is going on. What happened after this is that if you imagine, if you, in one way or the other, you try to make a division between your experience and what is not your experience, then you are going to arrive at such a point in which you are going to believe that there is a sort of ideal world from which you are going to take notions and concepts. This word was called essences. And this is connected with some Plato idea. Remember the idea of Plato, I think we discussed it, the idea of the cavern in which you know that this is a table because somewhere out there there is this ideal notion of table, a concept, who is in your brain, okay? Because you have that in your brain, and that's the essence, therefore you can associate that a piece of wood with four legs is a table, all right? This is more or less is the same. So, they are a system of universal essences. For phenomenology varies each object in imagination until it discovers what is invariable about it. You see? So, they try to see what is similar and what is different. It's a very simple middle. And then what is similar makes every object equal. And therefore, that are the essential characteristic of a particular object. What is different makes the object specific to one particular place. And that's it. So you see, it's not really complicated the way in which these people was thinking about. And then you can associate the idea, this idea of eternal or universal concept or essences. You can associate that to Plato, to the idea of the cavern. You can associate this to Kant. Immanuel Kant was talking about the idea of noumeno. Noumeno was that. Noumeno is something that you cannot directly perceive. It's the essence, you see. So you can be close to that, but never you can have a perception of that. But that noumeno is important because all the meaning, all the concepts are contained in that kind of dimension, if you want. So what the humans being do to have knowledge is to try to catch that noumeno, never arriving, but being closer and closer. So that's the idea. You see, this is what is called idealism. It's the idea that you have something which is ideal there, and in such a way either because your intellectual approach, either because your perceptual approach, you arrive to be close to that ideal. And that ideal dimension give you sense of reality, give you concept, give you the meaning of things, and so on. So at the end, phenomenology was idealist, if you want, according to Eagleton. In page 49, there is a kind of abstract, which is to say, it should be obvious, even from this brief account of phenomenology, that it is a form of methodological idealism, seeking to explore an abstraction, call it human consciousness, and a world of pure possibilities. But if Husserl rejected empiricism, psychologism, and the positivism of natural science, he also considered himself to be breaking with the classical idealism of a thinker like a Kant. Kant had been unable to solve the problem of how the mind can really know object outside it at all. Phenomenology, in claiming that what was given in pure perception is the very essence of things, hoping to surmount this skepticism. You see, basically this is the if you want, the abstract of what he was discussing. Eagleton simplified quite a lot, not only Husserl here, but all the others. I'm not quite sure to what extent this could be generalized in such a way. However, it is true, number one, that we can consider phenomenology a sort of idealism. And number two, if you want, in one way or the other, that idealism was the element who really was picking up by literary critics. And this is interesting. Why? Because if I say to you in the previous class that the same core, philosophical core, that can explain phenomenology, can explain hermeneutics and reception theory, it is true as well that reception theory and hermeneutics were trying to address this kind of idealism. Because you see, if you are an idealist person in terms of literature, that means that you believe that somehow, somewhere, even if you don't have access to that, there is the right interpretation of the book. And this is called intentio operis in Latin. It's the fact that you believe that the author have an intention. You don't know the author, you don't know the intention, doesn't matter. You know that that exists. Intentio operis. Yeah. Just give me 1 minute, I'm going to get out pencil, because if not, I will be done. Great. I'm in a class, do you mind to give me one marker? Yes. Because mine is just go down.
Well, I
lovely. Thank you. Sorry. Yeah, this has been, I imagine when you did your A levels, this was the key element for all your teachers. The fact that they ask you, what is the intention of the author? What is the intention of the author? You don't know the author. You are not in the head of the author. You don't have a clue. So, to prevent this negative side of the idealism from phenomenology is that hermeneutics and the reception theory set up the theory knowing the author anymore, but in the reader. So you pay attention to the reading, to the act of reading, to the empirical aspect of analysis. You see, therefore, you avoid this idealism, if you want, in one way or the other. And that is why, as I said before, Yost, Ricoeur, and all the other people from the hermeneutics perspective were concerned about the reader. Because if you want to do an analysis in literature, you pay attention to the reader. And there are other, in other disciplines, I'm thinking that you know all of you are working in literature, but an example, other disciplines were the same. An example in linguistics, if you want. during the 19th century, the discussion about societies were grounded in this idea to construct the ideal speaker, you see? So you get the ideal speaker and you can understand how the language, a particular language, is working. And in the 20th century it's completely the opposite. You do the survey, you do get the data, you empirically you realize how the people are talking, and then you have an idea of the language. You see, exactly the same. The idea of linguistics in the 19th century was grounded in this idea of intenti operis, applied to the speaker, in the sense in which you have an ideal speaker and then you apply to the practical one. And in the 20th century, you have what could be, if you want to put it in that way, you go to the speakers themselves, and then you have an idea of the language. You see, the principle is more or less the same. This didn't change that much. What else? Of course, I mean, the idea of intention in Husserl is the top of the system. He says, we might note, in that's page 50, how Husserl's intentional theory of consciousness suggests that being and meaning are always born up one with each other, one to the other, basically. Yeah. Let me put it this way. Maybe that's going to be more clear. What is the bloody... Today is not my day. Somewhere there? No? This is about the meaning of consciousness. This is very simple. So, you have a perception of the world. This is the world, okay? Basically, in philosophy in the 20th century, you have two possibilities. One possibility who says, an example, in that case, you can see, put here, anyway, Heidegger, an example, okay? I quote you philosophers, so you can. Heidegger discuss the idea of Dasein. Being the world. So, you have the world and you are inside the world, okay? So that's, if you want, in one way or the other, that's empirical. But then you have people like a Husserl who says, no, you are you and the world is in your mind. And that is idealism. You see, in one case you are inside the world, in the other case the world is inside your mind. And if you want, these are the two main schools, at least up to the Second World War, in which you can have, you can call it empirism, existentialism, whatever, the one in which the world exists and you are part of it. And then you can call idealism, if you want, the other perspective, in which the world is in your, the world is a state of the mind. The world is a consciousness thing. And that is indeed its user. Okay? So that's how the two to make things more clear.
What is the term is associated?
Yes, all the an example, Curtius. All the classical literary theories, all the theory who still believe intentions counts. Let me think, someone more. Curtius made works on medieval, let me think, I try to think of a clear, because all the institutions, let me put it in this way, all the literary institutions from the beginning of the century up to the Second World War were more or less in favor of this theory. Why? Because this theory of idealism justified the institution in the sense in which, because you always rely on something that is not there, you always can justify that the institution is exactly that. The institution is there to make sure that you have the possibility to grasp the right sense of things. Because this is the problem with idealism. Idealism believes that somewhere there is a truth, that somewhere there is a right interpretation. So what you need to do as a critic is to search for the right interpretation. So why this theory go very well with institution is because institutions see themselves as the one who kept the truth. Therefore, if you are part of the institution, you are part of the truth. You are doing the right interpretation. Therefore, an example, in France, this is very, very strong. If you want to promote yourself in academic career, you need to quote the right people. And quote the right people is to quote the member of the institution, you see. So there is no one who can say, as an example, like you can say Roland Barthes is associated with semiology in this kind of approach, because this approach was far more bigger but did not produce big figures. One, you can say, I don't know, I can tell you an example, a lot of writers, an example, I don't know, Romain Rolland, for example, even he, politically speaking, he was a person from left, very engaged. He was an idealist in terms of literature, always thinking in the right intention. All the socialist movements in France as well and elsewhere were associated with this idealism, because socialists were trying to persuade truth in society. Therefore, they were believing that truth should be as well channelized through art. If we have art, it's because we can have truth through the art. You see what I mean? If you don't have that, then the extreme situation of that, indeed, is the Stalinism in Russia, in which the artists were forced to produce reality art, and that's it, because according to them, the purpose of art was having just, you know, deliver some kind of idea of reality, or whatever they call it. I try to think, there is an interesting small book from Holamba, in which is a sort of dispute or debate that they made in the beginning of the 60s between Roland Barthes and one of the members of this academy, in which Roland Barthes made the point about literature and the other guy defend the position of idealism, if you want way, in one way or the other. Which is interesting, it's 40 pages, but if you read that, you can see how that distinctions are. Roland Barthes have a different perspective than what can be hiding. That's doesn't matter, but you can see from the side of the other guy clearly what is this idealism working in literature. And indeed the book is called Critique et Vérité, because exactly that was the point. As you imagine, Barthes' argument was that we talk about critique, period, and the argument of the other guy was we talk about critique, but we search the truth. Where is the truth, you see? So that is the picture. And
so then after, you said these are the two primary ways of thinking, so like in World War II, and then after the bottom one, he came up and moved into
what happened, this is, let me put it in this way, when you think in terms of the war, philosophically speaking, this is the picture before the Second World War. There are two ways to approach the world, if you want, in one way or the other. One is when you take an empirical approach, in which you are inside the world without possibility to take distance. Therefore, you construct a theory for that. Existentialism was for that theory, an example. And then you have another theory in which you believe that the world is in your consciousness, in one way or the other. That is a fact of consciousness. Therefore, there is nothing that can be, in one way or the other, I would say, construct from the perceptual point of view. What happened?
Yeah. Okay. There's a good book that explains all this very well, and it's, I mean, a child can read it. It's called by Norwegian. It's called Sophie's World or something like that.
Could be. I don't know that. No.
It's a history of philosophy. It's about a little girl who's being taught philosophy by this.
Oh, yes, someone mentioned that to me. How is the title of it?
It's good because you don't know anything.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I'm more mentioning
all this.
Yeah.
Very simple
term. Yeah. No, you see, what happened is, after the Second World War, things get complicated, in the sense in which these pure situations just disappear. Because an example, what happened is a lot of movement get a little bit of both. An example, one theory that I like very much is called constructivism. The constructivism picking up a little bit of idealism in relation with the theory of reality, but a little bit of pragmaticism regarding to how important experience is, an example. And then you have this theory do not apply that much or do not concern that much to literature, but certainly a lot for science, for linguistics, and so on. So I don't think that after the Second World War, the way in which we can describe these philosophical ideas transferred to literature is simple, in the sense in which you have four clean cuts. Why? Because this connection between philosophy and literature, who has been, let's face it, has been up to the Second World War almost direct. After that change. Why? Because what happened after the Second World War, as we discussed the previous class and not the other one, is that the other disciplines came up. So semiotics will start to be important, linguistics start to be important. So literary critics do not regard anymore philosophy as the only source of theory. They start to regard other disciplines. Sociology was important. So what you have after the Second World War is that a lot of other disciplines together with philosophy were coming together. And then is when you have, you know, people like Roland Barthes, who knowledge was not only basic in philosophy, more in sociology. Even anthropology started to be important. So it is true that from the literary point of view, you can identify maybe 5, 6, 7 schools through the second half of the 20th century. But the sourcing of this school is not only source, not only philosophy anymore. I still believe that philosophy can make things more simple because it's giving you the idea and then you apply that idea to different areas. But it is true as well that after the Second World War, some ideas coming from another areas, like a sociology, went into philosophy. So philosophy was not the first step always. An example, the idea of society. All this idea about how the culture, who is not a physical culture anymore, who is an abstract notion of culture, affect us. That is coming from sociology. The idea of the importance of the media in our life, in our understanding of the world, that is coming from sociology, in some cases from anthropology. It's not coming from philosophy. Philosophy took it and then developed it later, a little bit, but it's different. So, and then, of course, psychoanalysis as well, that we are going to see, is another area who has been developed. So this is a good picture of what happened at the beginning of the 20th century. But it is unlikely that you are going to have something clear as such after the Second World War. Especially because, an example, this idea of being in the world, then you have at least probably three schools. One who go to pure empiricism. Science, an example, in which what you get from the sense is what exists. If you cannot prove it, visually speaking, on perception way, do not exist. And that's a pure empiricism, if you want. The other is, if you want, the consequence, if you want, in some ways or the other, of existentialism, who instead to discuss idea of society, they move to the idea of individual, okay? More radical yet. And you have people like, an example, Michel Onfray, nowadays, who talk about philosophy or individual philosophy. And then, if you want, you have a third aspect in which is a school concentrated in the idea of experience, purely in the idea of experience. And then you have areas like a pure mathematics, applied linguistics, and so on. So you see, and this is just are the main, just to give you an example to you. Again, you can do the same with this. And of course, this as well get developed in another. So it's the panorama, I mean, it's really huge. But as I say in the previous class, what is important is that you, in a simple way, you understand the main idea. So if someone asks you, I don't know, say, what is phenomenology? Doesn't matter if you don't ever come across to Husserl. If you have a roughly an idea, what is the principle of phenomenology, that will be great. And you don't need to know more to understand something who was coming from phenomenology, because the principle is what is important. You're understanding the principle. So that is the... Maybe in that case, when you say, Simon, that book is okay, I don't know. How is the title of that book?
It's called something, Sophie's World or something.
Sophie's
like
World.
It might be. It's about a girl called Sophie.
Yeah. Yeah, I think someone mentioned that to me.
Yeah, it's in the Norwegian. Because I read it a few years ago.
It's
interesting.
Yeah.
I'm quite
fond of stories. All right. So, the world of a literary work is not an objective reality, Eagleton says, but what in German is called Lebensbild. Reality has actually organized and experienced it by individual subject. Well, that is one of the conclusions indeed that Joos and Ricoeur get from phenomenology. For Husserl, he keeps saying in 52, remember these are interpretations from Eagleton about Husserl. For Husserl, in other words, meaning is something which is predates languages. Language is no more than a secondary activity which gives names to meanings I somehow already possess. This is crucial, because this is the bloody discussion that all the 20th century has been carrying on and on and on and on. Could be your knowledge previous to your language? Is that possible? Yes or no? Depends if you say yes, is one thing. Depends if you say no, is another thing. So, you certainly can divide all the theories in the 20th century following this pattern. The people who say yes, like a Husserl, believe that you have some kind of intuition, some kind of non-language orientated knowledge of the world, in the sense in which you, when they are a child, you are embedded of this perception. Let's call it that way, which is not grounded in language, which is to not have a narrative structure. Who have that theory? That theory go back to Descartes, go back to the, if you want, to the persons who were following Plato, in the sense in which the knowledge of the concept who are fundamental for your life are not coming in a linguistic form. You learn them by intuition. And the main representative of that school nowadays, which is, I'm sure you know, is called Chomsky. This guy believes that we have only one language, that is the everyone has the same language, which is a consequence of this way of thinking. I mean, this way to believe that our knowledge is no longer than language at the beginning. Well, it's because he followed Descartes, therefore he says that we have a universal grammar. So everyone has the same pattern, you see. He discussed at the beginning, he had one book which is called Cartesian Language or something, I don't remember, from the 60s, in which he made a context of idea of language in connection with grammar. He's more concerned about grammar because his theory is about grammar. However, when he has been asked to put that in context, he discusses the idea of language grounded in the car. And the idea is, we have the same pattern, mentally speaking. I mean, all people, doesn't matter if we speak Chinese or whatever. What happened is that the application of that universal grammar is what is different. And therefore, someone speaks Chinese, some other speak English. That is what made the difference. But if you go back to the roots, then, number one, you don't have a structural language who allow you to understand what the way you understand things. And number two, everyone is the same. And this as well had to do with another discussion who has been going on and on and on in the 20th century, is to what extension you can explain your language grounded in anatomical perspective. Let's say, for instance, like Chomsky says, that there is the outward composition of the brain who make us to have a universal grammar. There are people who refuse to accept that position, in the sense in which they say you never can prove that the composition of your brain have a direct connection with this idea of grammar. You see, the question is how you balance, how far you can go in biological argument, how far you think biology or anatomy prove your way to perceive things or your way to speak about things. Some people believe that's important, some people believe that it is impossible to make the connection. And then again, you can divide all the theories about that. And of course, you imagine in literature, well, I mean, you have plenty of applications there, because, I mean, if you believe that, an example, just to make a simple interpretation, if you believe that your knowledge, your original knowledge, is not coming from language, from articulated language, then you are going to believe in intuition. Therefore, if you are an artist, you are going to believe in inspiration. Therefore, you are going to pay a lot of attention to poetry or to the arts, who are grounded in this idea that there is no a rational explanation. There is someone who produces in a certain moment a particular piece of work. Call it intuition, call it inspiration. But you cannot explain that production. Certainly you can explain what is the consequence of that production, what is the place of that particular object, how that object has been helping people, how the people have been using that object, and so on and so on and so on. But the real first moment in which that has been produced cannot be explained according to the theory. And then you have the other people who says the more crucial things in art is to explain the moment in which the art has been produced. And that perspective indeed is associated with people who believe that without language you don't know nothing, you don't have a sense of reality, you don't know the world. You see? The more extreme case, to compare with Chomsky, if you want, is Piaget, Jean Piaget. Piaget was having two kids. He was in Switzerland. He born in the last century, never in the 19th century. He died in, I think it was 62. Something like that, 62, 64. And he produced a theory about how you, an example of different theories. One was how we as human beings make up the sense of reality. He did so observing the child. He was having two child and he was observing the child. Different things. An example, how we construct the idea of object in our brain. An example, you can do it. I mean, I did it with my daughter, and I keep doing that way all the time. You took the child and you do this, and if you're going to see that the child always keep the you know, the face in the front, because they cannot construct yet in their mind the imaginary trajectory of the object behind them. You see, if you do that to another child, the child do that immediately because have a figurative sense of the object, but a baby do not have that yet. So he started to do observation like that and create the theory, in which basically is this: language is a base of knowledge, but also language is a base of understanding. So if you want to understand how people understand, you understand how language works, and that will be, if you want, not the solution, but at least the step forward. And I don't know, to be honest with you, personally I feel close to Piaget, not necessarily because I have an agreement about his linguistic view, but I have a philosophical view who put me close to them and to what was probably then constructivism later. I was working in science for a while, so. But to be honest with you, the same arguments, still this discussion going on, as a debate was between these two men. They met twice. There is a book who came up after this encounter. To be honest with you, I went to that book 10 times probably. I'm still having no clear what was the result of that. So, because there was too many things going on. But to be honest, what is more difficult now to prove, and Chomsky has been struggling, is to prove this idea of universal grammar. Especially because our society is so complicated that it's more and more difficult. Because let me be clear on this. Do not confuse, because there isn't a confusion sometimes when we discuss general ideas about Chomsky. One thing is if you have a dominant culture, okay, through the media, who set up a standard in terms of culture and in terms of standing, alright? Therefore, because everyone speaks English, our culture more or less is the same. That's one thing. But quite a different thing is what Chomsky is talking about. What I'm saying to you is that do not confuse a universal pattern of grammar with a universal way to perceive the world, because we have been trained by the monopoly of the media. I'm telling you because there are authors who made the connection immediately, and that's wrong. That's not necessary. The fact that Chomsky tried to persuade people that there is a universal grammar do not prove the success of our media. Forget it. That's not working that way. But certainly, there is a tendency to believe that to some extent we need to address the fact that we became more and more on a universal culture in one way or the other. The question is, can that theory, that planetary theory, could be grounded in language? We became more and more the same person talking the same language because we, at the end, we have a universal grammar, as probably Chomsky will be suggesting, or we are in that situation because there are political and ideological issues. You see, this is the discussion. And indeed, this is important because, an example, people like Chomsky have a relation with the media, very comfortable one. He says, the media are not bad itself. The media are bad if you use them bad. But the other, like Apache, will be saying, the media are catastrophic. An example, all the constructivism school in pedagogy advise the parents to not allow the children to go and see TV before they have 6. You see? So, radical, completely different perception. Imagine you can apply that to literature as well. I mean, for Chomsky, literature always is going to be good, in the sense in which you need to classify, maybe organize, or maybe pattern guidelines or something like that, and that will be okay. And for the other people, will be considering that there are bad literature and good literature, and you only need to pay attention to the good literature and not to the other. And instead, for people who follow Chomsky, literature will be not going to be bad or good, it's going to be circumstantial, according to the circumstance of the individual. You see, the consequence varies tremendously. Any question? No? Okay, we'll stop here. And I'm going to finish quickly. Next. And I will be starting anyway with the structuralism and semiotics. Okay? So, as for the class, let's have a pass this message to your colleague. Let's have an agreement. If I did say nothing to you, that means this is our standard meeting. If I mention something to you, I mention what is the change. Okay? So if I do not say nothing by email, nothing, Wednesday 9 to 10 and 11 to 12, we met here in the same time, in the same place. If I contact you, it's because we don't have class, or because we changed the class. Okay?
Is it possible to say a week before, at least?
Of course, yes. Or you contact me. You contact. Don't worry. I mean, I'm saying to you just to avoid you or a message. But if you contact me, I'm ready. Message, email.
What?
Yeah. For next week, I'm away. So you have that now. So I'm away next week. Yeah. And the following week, we are going to have class in this same time. So for the next 2 weeks, we are covered basically. And a colleague of mine asked me if I or you will be interested in having a sort of extra lecture on poetry and how you can approach poetry and so on. I thought that would be interesting for you, so I say yes. So he will be giving you an extra lecture somehow after Easter. Paul Cook, you know Paul Cook? So that will be, all right?
Are you not here next week? If you have, are you here the rest of this week?
Yes.
So if I even
maybe. Yes.
Yeah. So you're not here next week.
Yeah. No. No, I don't think so. I mean, I'm 80% sure. So Simon, you want to see me?
Yeah, possibly.
Yeah. Yeah. Why even? You have a minute? We can come down with me or?
I have to be working.
Well, I tell you, I send you an email.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you when I can. The better will be this week. Sometime tomorrow
morning.
Tomorrow morning. I'm teaching at 9. It's too early?
No, it's fine.
9 in my office. I have like 15, 20 minutes. That will be okay?
Yeah, fine.
Yeah, cool.
Well, I mean,
I'd
like to talk to you for longer, but
there's...
Yeah.
No, at least, I mean, what we're going to do is we set up what we need to do, okay. And then we divide it in days or whatever. I mean, that will be the issue.
Yeah.
All right? Okay. All right.